afternoon, everyone. Welcome to our next panel discussion. I'm Eileen O'Connor, Chairman of the Executive Committee of the Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group, which brings you this panel. Before I say a word about that, however, I move to acknowledge that today is Veterans Day, a day when we remember and honor the service of our armed forces. Today, November 11, is the day we do this because it was on this day in 1918 that an armistice was reached, bringing to an end the hostilities in what was then known as the War to End All Wars, and what we now call World War I. And I take this opportunity to read to you a few words from a citation for one bronze medal earned during World War II. On one occasion, he led his platoon at the head of a task force into Pressburg, Germany, and despite heavy cannon and machine gun fire, killed 40 enemy and routed the remainder. On another occasion, although wounded, while seizing an objective north of Tangeda, he evacuated several of the platoon's casualties under direct machine gun fire and then continued to lead his unit in the capture of three villages against severe opposition. Still another time, without support, he led his platoon across the Saul River and fought eastward 18 miles to obtain important knowledge of enemy strength and positions. The citation goes on, but those items get the point across. The 3.5-week period during which these activities occurred included the medal recipient's, no doubt, unacknowledged 25th birthday. That recipient was Lieutenant Joseph B. O'Connor. Thanks, Dad. God bless you. And God bless all United States military veterans, past and present, who have defended and continue to defend our great nation. I have two housekeeping matters to mention. If you're seeking CLE credit, you must sign in each day to receive the credit. If you've not already done so, use the QR code on the CLE card provided. If you don't have the card, volunteers in the room can provide one. The QR code is also posted outside the room on the easel. Please note that some states require that you not only sign in, but sign out. Point two, District of Columbia regulations require that each of us wear a mask except when we are eating or drinking. I'm reminded of an observation a bunch of tax lawyers made years ago, and it just made so much sense to me at the time. It said, in Germany, everything is forbidden unless it's specifically permitted. In the United States, everything is permitted unless it's specifically forbidden. In Italy, everything is prohibited, and everybody does it anyway. So I've noticed that most people are managing to drink most of the time, having something in their hand that they're about to drink if somebody notices they're not wearing a mask at the moment. Now back to the matter at hand. This panel is brought to you by the Executive Committee of the Administrative Regulation and Practice Group, putting together interesting and informative programs on important topics like this one is one of the things practice groups do. If you're not now a member of one of the Federalist Society's 15 practice groups, but would like a role in putting together interesting projects like this, I encourage you to join one. The topic of today's panel is administrative inquisitions, how agencies initiate, conduct, and conclude investigations. And I'm not sure which agency it is that's inquisiting right now. But that's all right, I can see. In addition to formal rulemaking and case-by-case adjudication and enforcement, federal agencies have long employed a myriad of mechanisms to influence and publish private behavior. Civil administrative investigations can be not only onerous, but also financially catastrophic, especially when the targets are small businesses and individuals. To what extent are these investigations bounded by the procedural constraints of the Administrative Procedure Act, traditional transparency protections, or the redress afforded by timely judicial review? Our distinguished panel will address these and related questions. We are delighted that our moderator for today's panel is the Honorable James Ho of the United States Court of Appeals for the Fifth Circuit. It's hard for me to believe that this coming January we'll see the fourth anniversary of Judge Ho's ascendance to the bench. Immediately before joining the court, Judge Ho was co-chair of the National Appellate and Constitutional Law Practice Group of Gibson, Dunn & Crutcher. Early in his career, among other demanding posts, Judge Ho served in the Justice Department's Office of Legal Counsel. This is where I first encountered him, and it has been a great pleasure to watch the progress of his career and continued service to the nation since then. Judge Ho.
Thank you, Lee. Thank you so much, Lee, and to the Federalist Society, and good afternoon, everyone. I'm grateful for the kind introduction, but I'm specifically grateful that Lee explained that everyone in the audience is supposed to wear a mask, because I'm from Texas, and where I'm from, if I saw everyone in a room wearing a mask, I'd be worried that we were being robbed. Now, as the moderator today, I am not going to say too much, both because we already have a great group of panel of experts here, and also because my voice is a bit hoarse, and so I do apologize for that. But don't worry, I've talked to my doctor. He said it's not COVID, I'm just allergic to Washington, D.C. We're all familiar with the structural constitutional issues presented when administrative agencies promulgate rules. Rules not written pursuant to Article 1, by officials not fully accountable to the President under Article 2, and subject to only deferential review under Article 3. But less attention has been paid to investigations conducted by administrative agencies, investigations not regulated by any law enacted by Congress, not subject to accountability to the President or his cabinet, and not subject to judicial review. Fortunately, the Society has assembled for us today an exceptional panel to explore these particular issues. And after their remarks, we will be welcoming questions from the audience. Our first speaker today will be Professor Aram Gavoor from the George Washington University Law School, and as I understand, hot off the presses, now the Associate Dean at the Law School. Oh. He is a nationally recognized scholar in administrative law and federal courts. As a Justice Department litigator, he has appeared in federal district and appellate courts nationwide, and he recently co-authored an article on administrative investigations with Stephen Platt, an article that has largely prompted much of our discussion today. Next, we'll hear from Professor Richard Pierce, also from the George Washington University Law School. He has written over 20 books and 130 articles about administrative law, and in particular about the effects of government intervention on the performance of markets. And his books and articles have been cited in hundreds of court opinions, including over a dozen Supreme Court opinions. Next will be Tyler Clarkson, who serves as Associate General Counsel at a synthetic biology company, where he handles all manner of regulatory and compliance issues. And he previously served as Deputy General Counsel, Principal Deputy General Counsel, and Acting General Counsel at the U.S. Department of Agriculture. And then we will hear from Susan Rodriguez, a partner at McGuire Woods, where she is co-lead of the firm's financial institutions industry team. She focuses primarily on government investigations and complex civil litigation. She previously served as a policy advisor at the Department of Homeland Security, and also clerked for Judge Frank Whitney on the United States District Court for the Western District of North Carolina. Professor, would you like to get us started?
Yes. Thank you to the Federalist Society and Dean Reuter for hosting this event, and to the Administrative Law and Regulation Practice Group and our chair, Leo Connor, for selecting this panel. And also, I want to personally thank Stephen Platt, who's sitting right over there, if you could raise your hand. He's the other half of this little outfit in terms of the scholarship that we're discussing today and for which the panel is based. So when I wrote my remarks for this, we hadn't had one of these in a while. I didn't realize I'd recognize about 40 people in this room, all very heavy hitters. But for those of you who don't know, the fundamental rudiments of administrative investigations, I kind of view it as the dark matter of administrative law. This happens, it exists, is mostly necessary for the parts of administrative law that we are aware of, the stuff that's subject to positive legal constraints contained in the Administrative Procedure Act of 1946. And those of us who are experts in the subject matter are actually experts in silos of the subject matter. You can have financial services experts in investigations, experts for inspector general's investigations from the Department of Health and Human Services, experts for the Wage and Hour Division for Fair Labor Standards Act violations. But there hasn't been a single transubstantive constitutional account for administrative investigative behavior. And that's one of the questions that I and my co-author are looking to explore in an article titled Administrative Investigations that'll be published in the Indiana Law Journal later this year. So when I say me or I mean we. Imagine that you're running a small business that facilitates, say, the sale of gently worn children's clothing on a consignment basis by renting space and using volunteer staff of your consigners as assistants for in exchange for early marketplace access. That is among the most benign businesses I can think of. Yet nonetheless, also imagine that you don't live near Washington, D.C. You live in some place, perhaps rural, and your interactions with the federal government are usually in the mail, paper. And then imagine that an investigator from the Wage and Hour Division of the Department of Labor comes knocking on your business's door, smiling, of course, asking about whether it's possible to inspect the books for employees, just to check and make sure that the FILSA of 1938 is being complied with. Not a big deal. Just a quick polling of the audience. Good idea to let that person in. No, well, that's of course, we know better, but the American regulated public mostly does not. Well, the rubber meets the road, of course, where first, the Hobson's choice, where the investigator is let in, inspects documents, maybe takes them away to make copies and brings them back, and then all of a sudden, a few days or weeks later, you get an enforcement letter for violation of the FILSA of 1938 with some sort of calculated amount of back wages, which would have a consequenting tax consequence that flows from it. You don't really have many opportunities to challenge it, and heavens, you wouldn't want to because you're a small business. You don't have the resources to handle that kind of asymmetric power relationship. Or you could choose option B, not let the person in. Then they'll start potentially insinuating or implying that they have the power of compulsion upon you and that they might come back with some more heavily enforcement-minded demeanor with an express authority to do so. So it's not a really easy body of options. Well, this conduct, this behavior happens all the time in the United States. And I'm talking just at the federal level, across many agencies, across with perhaps many of your clients. And many of us who have been in federal government understand the sheer power that federal investigative authority lends, not just to engage in what I style a statutorily linear investigation of potential violations, audits that are required by the law, but sometimes, and especially when there are a few constraints to regulate that conduct of government, it can be punitive. It can be crushing to businesses, to individuals. And it can also cause behavioral change as a function of regulation that does not find its way into the Federal Register. So my co-author and I, we hypothesize just this and tried to write the first law review article that covers all of this material. We had to cut about, 20,000 words? But the hope and the goal that at least I bring to bear for this interaction is that first, we can all agree upon the fact that this indeed exists. Second, that it is largely unregulated. By the way, it is unregulated by the Administrative Procedure Act of 1946. There are no positive procedures for agency investigative conduct. Third, this presents a problem. And fourth, maybe the areas upon which we can have the rich disagreement that is germane to these panels might be upon the solutions for it. And hopefully those of you who are scholarly inclined might do some further research on it. And for those of you who are litigation inclined might find that there could be an appropriate basis to perhaps stand up a little more and engage in something otherwise than capitulation when government comes knocking in semi-legitimate ways. So our research, the big key of all of this, is that in the mid-20th century, in two cases, Oklahoma Press and Publishing Company versus Walling from 1946, the year of the APA's enactment, and the United States versus Morton Salt, which many of us are familiar with, from 1950, laid out a framework that was starkly distinct from the judiciary's prior engagement with agency investigative conduct and took a very hospitable and deferential approach, and also did so using, I think, distinctly different factual predicates then than what exists now, with a substantially larger federal government, with a substantially larger federal bureaucracy, and substantially more perhaps politicized and policy-oriented investigative conduct. Well, in so ceding, or at least recalibrating the separation of powers from a constitutional law structural perspective, agencies were granted enormous bodies of deference to engage in all kinds of investigative conduct using relatively minimalistic statutory grants, using tactics that many would style as coercive, and having a wide body of discretion that perhaps they really shouldn't have. Because as we know, government works more effectively when there are limiting principles put into place, when there are guideposts by which the government must comport when it engages in its conduct, and there are opportunities for those who have grievance with the government to seek redress before the Article III courts. We lack many of those features in the context of administrative investigations. So the example I gave, Riolana versus the Department of Labor, was a case that I personally was involved with in the litigation on the business owner's side. And that, I think, is striking because the first case that I mentioned, Oklahoma Press and Publishing Company, was a wage and hour case. The other case, Morton Salt, was a Federal Trade Commission case, and the example that I immediately think of is LabMD, that mid-2010s enforcement action where the Federal Trade Commission, reading quite expansively its own Section 5 authority for data security purposes, investigated a cancer laboratory testing company, small business, essentially into oblivion. The investigation killed the company, not even in the enforcement action that followed. So this type of conduct undoubtedly strikes me as not sound for a free and liberal society, and certainly feels, to my read of the APA, using whatever methodology you prefer, textualism or even purposivism, well off-piste. So the question then is, what do we do about it? We know that agencies uniformly investigate, and also I think from a maximalist perspective, and I think we have some maximalists in the audience, if you just completely shut down agency investigative authority, well, the federal government stops. I'm approaching it from a more pragmatic perspective as drawn from Supreme Court behavior. If the court is hesitant to even write off our deference by chevronizing it into Kaiser versus Wilkie, which is almost impossible to meet, it is highly improbable, you know, that a significant litigation or two is going to solve this problem. What I think this calls for is principled and strategic incrementalism, especially because I'm living in a reality where Congress is in significant torpor. Obviously, the first place we would go to for some sort of a solution to the problem. So in the context of using the tools that are practically available to us, really it's the courts, and there's a number of different solutions that can be brought to bear. The first would be really pressing back on the Fourth Amendment and the Fifth Amendment predicates from Morton Salt and Oklahoma Press. I think, and of course I'm constrained by time, there's a variety of opportunities that well-situated litigators and companies that are willing to take the risk, of course, where capitulation carries with it a very high cost, can use to press back. The APA itself, like I said, has very little affirmative regulation, positive procedures for agency action of this regard. Well, first, it's not technically agency action, it's sort of pre-action. My definition of it with my co-author is that it is information gathering using any number of tools, CIDs, subpoenas, inspections, and the like, that are in a pre-enforcement, pre-adjudicative context. Thus the investigation. Once you're in the adjudication, you fall within the domain of the APA. But also the APA, as we have seen with the Supreme Court's 2010s behavior, in the context of 704 reviewability, has expanded Bennett versus Speer and Sackett, and also with Hawks. So the more that this conduct can turn into something that can be styled as final agency action, that can be a basis for Article III review, because ultimately the goal is, can we get this into court to review it? And then to what degree are there limiting principles that the court can deploy to protect the individual liberties? And I suppose the last that, within the time constraints I have time to articulate, is it's possible that the court could also read agency investigative authority more narrowly. At a maximalist perspective, apply a clear statement rule with regard to agency positive investigative authorities, but undoubtedly perhaps to offer more opportunities for motions to quash or for underlying challenges of the legitimacy of agency conduct based on the stated reason up front. Thank you very much, and I very much look forward to the rest of the panelists.
Professor Pierce.
Thank you, Your Honor, and I really appreciate the invitation from the Federalist Society to talk to you folks today about this important subject. I'm going to use Dean Gavore's article, the article that he wrote with Stephen Platt, as my frame of reference in discussing this topic. For those of you who haven't yet read it, I commend it to everyone's attention. It's divided into five parts. And the first four parts are extraordinarily, encyclopedic. They're comprehensive and persuasive accounts of four different points that I think he makes quite effectively. First, agency investigative powers are important, and they're understudied. I cannot remember reading any prior systematic study of agency investigations. So then he makes the point that that agencies have very broad powers that are subject to only a few relatively weak limits. I think that's absolutely right, though I agree completely that Sackett and Hawks, two of the two cases he mentioned, are really quite important in this respect, where the court showed great empathy for, particularly in these cases, it was farmers whose land had been classified as waters of the United States, and the court showed a lot of empathy for them and said, they could get immediate judicial review of the jurisdictional determination. And those two Supreme Court opinions have rippled all through the circuit courts and caused circuit courts to be more willing to intervene at earlier stages in agency decision-making processes. So those can be helpful. I certainly also agree with another point that Dean Gavor documents well. There is the potential for abuse of these very broad powers and the potential for abusive use of them to cause a lot of damage. In Section 5, Dean Gavor gives us a very rich menu of options of ways we might try to address this phenomenon. He uses appropriately cautious language, and I would urge caution in thinking about how best to address them. I've always believed that by far the most powerful law is the law of unintended consequences. I think it's important to remember that there are a lot of individuals and a lot of companies that engage in violation of laws that produce a tremendous amount of harm to society, and that agencies have a very important function of investigation to determine and identify such violations of law and do something about them. And any additional procedural hurdle or opportunity for judicial intervention in the investigation process will necessarily force the agency to divert resources from its other tasks, and that in turn will reduce their ability to perform those important tasks. Now, with that in mind, what I did is I looked at the rich menu of options that Dean Gavor has in Section 5, and I have neither the time nor the expertise, frankly, to give you a valuation of all of them, but I have identified two that I think are particularly promising, and then two that I don't think are promising. So I'll just describe each. So the two that I find promising are internal separation of functions, where the agency enforcement personnel are not allowed to talk with the decision-making personnel, and the investigators are not allowed to communicate with the decision-making personnel. That is a very important principle. It Congress included it in the Administrative Procedure Act, applicable to any circumstance in which an agency is engaged in formal adjudication. And the Supreme Court in Withrow v. Larkin went out of its way to commend that congressional decision. I think it's a very important principle, a very, very important way of protecting interests of regulated firms. Unfortunately, Congress then created the option of using informal adjudication where there are no such requirements. So a lot of agencies have that discretion, and they use the less formal informal adjudication approach with none of the safeguards that apply to formal adjudication, including no requirement of separation of functions. There is an easy fix for that, and it really relates to the second suggestion in Dean Gavor's article that I find promising, and that is to get agencies to develop and to issue their own rules that circumscribe their powers, that state very clearly what they can and cannot do, their personnel can and cannot do, in the course of investigations. There's a very good recent article in Duke Law Journal by Kent Barnett, in which he goes through the process through which an agency can add safeguards that Congress neglected to include in the statute through the rulemaking process, and then those rules bind the agency as well as everybody else. And the fact that the agency makes those rules when it's thinking about the concerns that are raised by broad investigative powers assures that the agency is going to be looking at them with much greater care in a very different way than when the folks on the ground who are conducting a particular investigation are just potentially carried away by the facts of that case and have a tendency to engage in abusive behavior. Well, they can't do that if and to the extent that the agency has previously issued rules that say that they can't. And you can force an agency to look at that prospect quite seriously by filing a petition for rulemaking, asking them to issue such a rule, and if the agency refuses to do it, that's judicially reviewable. So I think that's a very promising approach. So let me just mention two that he suggests that I think are not at all promising. One is that he puts it this way, the agency should have rules of evidence. Well, they all have rules of evidence, but most of them are just very, very broad and permissive. I'm guessing he's talking about what a number of people have urged, that they adopt the federal rules of evidence. I've been teaching that subject for 40 years now, and they're just totally inappropriate for use in agency proceedings. They're designed for a jury trial, and have no application at all to agency proceedings. I studied that topic in 1986 for the administrative conference, and the conference voted 100-0 in favor of a recommendation that agencies never use the federal rules of evidence. The second one is he suggests that perhaps agencies could be told that they cannot have access to privileged matters. And that, I think, is also not a promising idea. People have been burying incriminating evidence in alleged privileged documents forever. It is a standard technique just to mention a recent illustration of it. Michigan State, when it assembled all of the documents that made it absolutely clear that Larry Nassar was systematically engaging in sexual abuse of the athletes at Michigan State, the response by one of the senior administrators in the meeting when they looked at those documents was, let's send them all to the lawyers and tell them to claim attorney-client privilege. Now, of course, attorney-client privilege doesn't apply, but you don't know that without going through the documents themselves. So I think that's also a non-starter. But I certainly agree that this is a good time to look with great care at what the broad powers that agencies have to try to identify some ways of confining, limiting those powers that will not cause too much problems for the agencies in their ability to carry out their missions. Thank you.
Is this on? Great. I think we got the coach side of the table, so I'm not going to climb in and out here with first class over there. Thank you, Judge Ho, for moderating today's panel. Thank you to the Federalist Society for addressing this topic and my fellow panelists for participating. By way of a quick disclaimer, I am speaking strictly in my personal capacity, not on behalf of my employer, the prior administration, or the like. Aram has laid out the landscape as it presently exists, the academic literature, the case law, and some of the larger problems that administrative enforcement entails. I'll focus on what I'd suggest are historic administrative law reforms that took place in the previous administration. and when taken together, earlier Republican presidents did not undertake. Part of the appetite for such reform is a testament to the maturation of the Federalist Society and its influence on the debate related to the rule of law. And credit goes to the prior administration and President Trump for pursuing an agenda that didn't yield to Beltway resistance. Much of the reforms that I'll recount today are of lower political salience, though of fundamental importance to the rule of law. Put another way, the political capital required to push these reforms through here in Washington doesn't necessarily redound to the president's benefit across the rest of the country. Nonetheless, President Trump issued three separate executive orders that fundamentally changed, at least while they remained in force, the relationship between U.S. citizens and the administrative state. I will mention the first two briefly, but I will focus more of my remarks on the third EO of importance, the so-called Regulatory Bill of Rights. In October of 2019, President Trump signed Executive Order 13891, which I will refer to as the Guidance EO. The Guidance EO brought sanity to agency guidance practices. As a matter of course, agencies often clarify existing obligations through non-binding guidance documents, which the APA exempts from notice and comment requirements. However, agencies sometimes use this authority inappropriately to try to regulate the public without following the rulemaking procedures of the APA. Even when accompanied by a disclaimer that it is non-binding, a guidance document issued by an agency may carry the implicit threat of an enforcement action if the regulated public does not comply. Moreover, the public frequently has insufficient notice of guidance documents, which are only sometimes published in the Federal Register and rarely, if ever, distributed to all regulated parties. Under the Guidance EO, it was the policy of the executive branch, to the extent consistent with applicable law, to require that agencies treat guidance documents as non-binding, both in law and, importantly, also in practice. Agencies were to take public input into account when appropriate in formulating guidance documents and to make guidance documents readily available to the public. Agencies were permitted to impose legally binding requirements on the public only through regulations, that is, through notice and comment rulemaking, and on parties on a case-by-case basis through adjudications and only after appropriate process. Such an approach to guidance has the practical effect of limiting an agency's potential administrative enforcement authority. Ensuring an agency sticks to its enabling statute or statutes and notice and comment rules for enforcement purposes has the effect of limiting its jurisdiction. An agency cannot issue a guidance document to expand its enforcement authority and/or apply its authority to an entirely unforeseen circumstance absent an intervening notice and comment rule. That kind of limitation, though perhaps not the direct aim of a rule of law approach to guidance documents, is nonetheless a desirable externality. Turning to Executive Order 13892, which President Trump also signed in October of 2019, and I'll refer to as the Administrative Enforcement EO, in much the same way that the Guidance EO served as a necessary predicate to the Regulatory Bill of Rights in EO 13924, so too did the Administrative Enforcement EO. Under the Administrative Enforcement EO, the prior administration set a policy whereby parties must know in advance the rules by which the federal government will judge their actions. No person should be subjected to a civil administrative enforcement action or adjudication absent prior public notice of both the enforcing agency's jurisdiction over particular conduct and the legal standards applicable to that conduct. Further, the Administrative Enforcement EO required agencies to publish a rule and procedure that governed administrative inspections. Both of these EOs serve as the necessary foundation for the big step the prior administration took to bring due process and consistency to administrative enforcement. On May 19, 2020, the President signed Executive Order 13924. The EO aimed to provide regulatory relief to businesses and support economic recovery after the first COVID wave. The so-called Regulatory Bill of Rights appeared in Section 6 of that EO. And at this point, what I'd like to do is just walk you through those protections because I do think they're responsive to some of what's discussed, been discussed already, and some of it's been endorsed, others not. So Executive Order 13924, Section 6, the Reg Bill of Rights, in the first instance, the first protection was that government should bear the burden of proving an alleged violation of law. The subject of enforcement should not bear the burden of proving compliance. And after that EO was issued in May, OIRA on August 31st, I believe it was, issued an implementing memorandum in which, at least with respect to this protection, they suggested that members of the regulated public should not be required to prove a negative to avoid liability and enforcement consequences. Only if a statute requires otherwise should the regulated public face such a burden. The second protection stated that administrative enforcement should be prompt and fair. And here, in its implementing memorandum, OIRA instructed that agencies should seek approval from an officer of the United States, that is, in most cases, if not all, someone who's politically responsible, before entering into a tolling agreement, for instance, that would have the effect of extending the statute of limitations for an infraction. In addition, OIRA encouraged agencies to consider a regulation for applying limiting principles to the duration of an investigation. The third protection, articulated in the Regulatory Bill of Rights, said that administrative adjudicators should be independent of enforcement staff, something we can agree on. And this particular protection in the implementing memorandum suggested that the protection aimed to apply more broadly the ex parte protections contained in the APA for formal adjudications. The fourth protection stated, consistent with any executive branch confidentiality interests, the government should provide favorable relevant evidence in possession of the agency to the subject of an administrative enforcement action. This, in short, applied the Brady protection from the criminal context to the administrative enforcement context. And here, in its implementing memorandum, OIRA instructed that agencies consider Brady, Giglio, and Kyles, and that agency officials should timely disclose exculpatory evidence to the target of an enforcement. Likewise, agencies should automatically disclose evidence material to the mitigation of damages or penalties. The fifth protection, which has not been as warmly received on this panel, is that all rules of evidence and procedure should be public, clear, and effective. And here, OIRA strongly implored agencies to seek to reduce the use of hearsay evidence in administrative enforcement adjudications, and that agencies should generally require the application of the Daubert framework to determine the veracity of scientific evidence. Agencies should make their rules of evidence and procedure easily accessible on their websites. The sixth protection was that penalties should be proportionate, transparent, and imposed in adherence to consistent standards and only as authorized by law. Agencies were instructed here in the implementing memorandum to establish policies of enforcement discretion that decline enforcement or the imposition of a penalty when the agency determined that the regulated party attempted in good faith to comply with the law. The OIRA implementing memorandum here also directed agencies to make the public aware of conditions in which investigations and enforcement actions will be brought and to provide the public with information on the penalties sought for common infractions. Seventh protection was that administrative enforcement should be free of improper government coercion. And here, OIRA encouraged agencies to consider protections that would guard against retaliatory or punitive motives or the desire to compel capitulation. Such things should not form the basis for an agency's selection of targets for investigations or enforcement actions or other investigations, enforcement decisions, or the like. The eighth protection in the Regulatory Bill of Rights stated that liability should be imposed only for violations of statutes or duly issued regulations after notice and an opportunity to respond. Here, OIRA encouraged agencies to consider that in any document initiating an investigation or enforcement action, an agency should include a citation to the statute and regulation asserted to be violated and an explanation as to how the asserted conduct is prohibited by that statute or regulation. The ninth protection was that administrative enforcement should be free of unfair surprise, and the tenth protection was that agencies must be accountable for their administrative enforcement decisions. And here, the implementing memorandum stated that in addition to the substantive mandates of the APA, the initiation of investigations and enforcement actions should carry the structural protection of requiring approval of an agency official who is an officer of the United States, again trying to introduce some measure of political accountability. And so I know this was not, to provide a little context here too, this was not something that in the EO that was issued bound agencies to initiate rulemaking on. It strongly encouraged department heads to consider whether these principles of fairness ought to be applied in their administrative enforcement context. And OIRA sort of doubled down on that, albeit still not in a fashion that bound agencies. And so between the summer of 2020 and the fall of 2020, we found ourselves largely in a position where we didn't have adequate time, I think, to do this in the way that it should be done. And happy to talk about that some as we get into Q&A, but with that, happy to yield the floor too.
Well, I'm very grateful to Tyler for setting the precedent that we could sit down and speak to you all, because I was wondering how I'm going to get over there gracefully without falling off the stage here. So thank you. I'd first like to say just what an honor it is to be here with this esteemed panel on this important topic. I was, just before we stood up, I told now Dean Gavore that when I read his article, I felt like I was reading a novel that I was actually living. I see this every day in my practice, and I'll say, just as Tyler said, these views are my own views and that not that of my employer or my clients, but as we were preparing for today, I promised the panel that I would bring the practitioner's view with several examples or case studies, if you will, that I've seen over the years. As Judge Ho mentioned earlier, I practice in the area of government investigations. And I often see when there is a civil investigative demand or administrative government subpoena that seems very innocuous at first, and then suddenly we are faced with a criminal investigation. So here's a few things I'd like to go through. First, I'm going to talk about the Consumer Financial Protection Bureau, the CFPB. There's two things that I would like to talk about here. First, the civil investigative demand, CIDs, and then using enforcement actions to create rules outside and circumventing the rulemaking process. So it's been really interesting. I don't know if anyone else in the audience has sort of followed the CID process with the CFPB. I mean, obviously the CFPB has only been around for a few years, so it's really easy to study that evolution. So most of you know a CID can be issued by the CFPB to companies or a witness, compelling them to produce information or to submit to an interview with the CFPB. Now, there is the Consumer Financial Protection Act of 2010, of course, authorizes the Bureau to issue these investigative subpoenas when it's looking at violations of law. And the CID, as we all know, usually is the signal of a start of an investigation. Perhaps you're the target, and sometimes if you're lucky, maybe you're just a third-party witness. We've seen both. But these CIDs are incredibly burdensome. Sometimes I've seen requirements to provide whole databases of information within just a 2 or 3 week time frame. There's little room to negotiate with the CFPB enforcement attorneys. In the early years of the CFPB, companies and banks wanted to challenge the scope of these CIDs, but we're disincentivized to do so for numerous reasons. One, it's very costly to challenge these CIDs. And as someone I was talking to earlier thought this was the most important point, you risk upsetting your regulators. So if you were a bank or a fintech company, some of your clients are fearful that if you push back on a regulator, there's a taint that will follow the company or the bank for years that money and litigation cannot repair. For some companies, there are also shareholder considerations. Sometimes your hands are tied and there's no appetite to fight back if a matter can be quickly and quietly resolved with a reasonable civil monetary penalty. Now, I wrote about this back in 2013 when an entity was one of the first to challenge a CID over a privilege issue. And Professor, I'm glad you brought up privilege issues. This was in the U.S. District Court for the District of Columbia. Although this was not the main issue in the case, the court reiterated in a response to a civil investigative demand, a recipient may withhold responsive material based on a claim of privilege. And this is the important part. The court noted that the CIDs issued by the Bureau are not self-enforcing, and therefore the Bureau could have not have compelled information without a court proceeding in which a claim of privilege could be asserted. Now, for us in the room, this may not sound very far-fetched now. This sounds like common sense. But at the time, this was a groundbreaking thought on CIDs. When you compare that also, some of you may be aware of 12 U.S.C. 1828X. In the supervisory capacity of the CFPB, they actually can review privileged materials. So let me just say that again. The CFPB can actually review your privileged materials. It's very similar to the privilege that the OCC has, where they can also review a bank's privileged materials. It does not waive the privilege and future litigation. But imagine that, and even though that's in a supervisory context, I have seen personally enforcement attorneys get together with the supervisory attorneys and they share information. So this is a very concerning thing to look at and to see how that can play out. Now, to go, Tyler, to what you were saying, this was just before some of the October 2019 EOs that came out, but in April of 2019, the CFPB announced policy changes regarding these CIDs. It announced that the CIDs will provide more information about the applicable provisions of law that may have been violated. So the CFPB promised to provide recipients of these CIDs more information, because before they had been very secretive. Oftentimes when you get a CID, they may not even tell you exactly what they're investigating. And that's really troublesome for companies who don't know why the information is being requested or how to properly defend itself. Now, I'd also like to talk about RESPA. RESPA is a very interesting case study here, I would submit, because if you look prior to the Trump administration, there was a trend going on at the CFPB of using RESPA enforcement actions to make rules, but not using the rulemaking process. It was very interesting. So before the Trump administration, about a third of all enforcement actions at the CFPB were RESPA related. So as you may recall, the Real Estate Settlement Procedures Act, by the way, RESPA carries both civil and criminal penalties. So I vividly remember interview with the CFPB where I had an individual, and he had accepted some Super Bowl tickets. And we had to make a judgment call. Do we reveal this to the CFPB? Because technically that would be a violation of RESPA. But RESPA just doesn't have civil penalties. It has criminal penalties. And as all good CFPB attorneys, at the very beginning of those investigative interviews, it's very intimidating, because they will recite the 1001 rule to you and remind you that if you give a false statement to the government, there will be consequences. Now, thankfully, we made the right call in that case. We did not get referred over to Department of Justice for criminal prosecution. But that is just, you know, some of the things that you're facing with RESPA. Now, another interesting thing is, some of you all might remember back in 2015, there was not a proposed rule. There was no commenting. There was no final rule. Instead, in 2015, the CFPB issued a bulletin on marketing service agreements and RESPA. Now, what was interesting about this is this came on the heels of several enforcement actions. So you might remember Lighthouse, New Day, and others. And it basically warned the industry that was using marketing service agreements. That is, if I want to advertise or jointly market and I am a provider of a settlement service, for example, a lender, I have to be very careful about partnering with title companies, home warranty companies, and others. If I have an agreement with them to provide advertising services, I need to make sure that I'm not paying them improperly for referrals. Now, some of you all might remember that this ended up at the Supreme Court, but I would like to not even go to the Supreme Court so far, but actually talk about the D.C. Circuit and the PHH case. I'm sure some of you all closely followed that that action. You know, Ted Olson argued that case, and it was really interesting because there was, in the D.C. Circuit, when they heard this, it was then Judge Kavanaugh, now Justice Kavanaugh, was talking to during oral argument and questioned whether the CFPB gave fair notice of its interpretation of RESPA. And alluded to the widespread understanding in the industry that the MSAs were legal under prior HUD guidance if you followed certain rules. And then this was my favorite part. In a colorful comment, Judge Kavanaugh, now Justice Kavanaugh, analogized the CFPB's sanction of PHAs to a police officer saying, you can cross the street here, but then gives you a $1,000 ticket when you get to the other side. Now, after all of this happened, some of you who follow the CFPB might remember last fall at the end of the Trump administration, they came out with some new RESPA guidance, which were just questions and answers. Again, no rulemaking or anything like that, but there were questions and answers, and they finally did rescind that 2015 bulletin that most of the industry had been following. So I'll conclude with the CFPB, and I'll move on to another example, which I think is really interesting. It comes from my time when I was at Homeland Security, and I still do a few of these now, but ICE subpoenas. So everyone probably knows, if you've ever worked for a company, you have to go in, and on the first day of work, you complete your Form I-9. Does everybody remember doing that? So you submit your passport or your driver's license, social security card, your birth certificate. And for those of you who follow that, there's about an 80-page handbook that the government issues on compliance with Form I-9s. And if you fail to comply, the government can come in, they can do a notice of inspection, and they can fine you for every single paperwork violation. So if you're completing the form and the company inadvertently leaves off the driver's license number, you can be fined about $240 to about $2,400 per Form I-9. Kind of interesting to think about. But here's where the interesting part comes in. So ICE can issue a notice of inspection, and that is part of an administrative summons that they issue to the company. They can actually come into the company without prior notice, provide this administrative summons, and here's what they'll get in return. They can request your Form I-9s, and if you keep copies of every one of your employees' driver's license and social security cards, they will get copies of all of that too. They can ask for your tax records. They can ask for your payroll records. They can ask to interview you, and they do so. And so you can see how this can start out as a civil investigation, but if you have maybe a landscaping company where you're down in Florida and you happen to have maybe some workers who aren't work authorized but submitted fake documents, well, maybe the company didn't know about it, but you are now being looked at in a criminal capacity. Did you know or did you not know that you may have been employing unauthorized workers? So you can see how a innocent, so-called innocent, administrative subpoena and summons can quickly turn into a criminal investigation, and nowhere at the beginning of this inspection did you have any Fourth Amendment rights, and we'll talk about some of this. That's at least ICE's position when that happens. Now, the reason I said that when I read your article, Dean Gavor, I love that he had a footnote on the Department of Justice Immigrant Employee Rights section. Now, this used to be the Office of Special Counsel. Some of you all may know it by that, but now it is called Immigrant Employee Rights Section, IER, part of the Civil Division. Now, they have the power to investigate, and I wanted to tell, this is public, it's in a published decision, an administrative decision, but I once had a company where they came to me and they had received an investigation, a subpoena, where they had to provide a lot of information. They had to provide all of their I-9s and submit to numerous rounds of interviews. And it was all because an individual had complained that the company had asked for a copy of his Social Security card and followed up outside of the Form I-9 process. So this little section at DOJ has the right to investigate potential discrimination, but they are bound by a statute that includes who are protected individuals, and that should contain their jurisdiction. That's under 8 U.S.C. 1324B. However, in this particular instance, DOJ kept investigating, and ultimately they ended up fining the company for conduct that was totally unrelated to what they were originally looking for. And ultimately the individual ended up suing in an administrative complaint, the company, and I got to argue that the DOJ investigation should have never happened because this particular complainant, this individual who complained, was not protected under the statute. They did not fall into the statutory definition of a protected individual. And you query whether the Department of Justice should have ever been investigating in the first place, because it was easily to find. It was easy to find whether or not he met the definition of a protected person or not. He did not. We successfully argued that through an administrative panel. But I will say, unlike the example that I used with ICE and the summonses, the Department of Justice Immigrant Employee Rights Section has a more robust administrative process that you can follow to sort of challenge these things. They have an administrative law body that I went to, and that's where this published decision, which is buried somewhere on OCOHO's website, that you can find that talks all about this. And interestingly, if I had lost, you know, at that level, I could have went straight to a U.S. Court of Appeals. I would skip the district court altogether. So I wanted to say that because I thought to juxtapose, you know, the ICE administrative subpoena where you don't really have a lot of rights to challenge it versus the Department of Justice Immigrant Employee Rights Section where you do have a more robust opportunity to challenge it might be interesting as we study this area. So I'll conclude with just some thoughts on, I do agree with you that this is an area that needs to be studied. It is very complex and challenging to study, however. FOIA limits really prohibit, even though sometimes you might be able to get certain information, a lot of agencies will do everything they can to avoid any release of investigative issues under FOIA. It's often unknown what agencies and bureaus are doing in this area, and you only know about it from practitioners or professors. There's little by way of statistics out there on this topic. I've also considered the judicial option, and we've talked some how those have been successful today, but I do struggle with this option. There are challenges. You know, it's a catch-22. I think most of us in this room probably agree that judges ought to be bound by judicial restraint. There's a precedent for deference to agencies, and so how do you address it with that backdrop? Maybe when we talked about the civil to criminal investigations, perhaps the Fourth Amendment is a way to do that. I've also thought about the congressional solution, and that might work, but I think that really needs to be studied more, and we need to consider what might happen. I guess be careful what you wish for, because if you did go the congressional solution, it might not turn out so well. So with that, thank you so much for allowing me to be here, and we'll look forward to the Q&A portion.
So while we wait for any members of the audience to approach, I think we have some microphones around the room. While we wait for that, I do want to invite members of the panel to respond to one another to the extent that there are any. Professor?
Thank you, Your Honor. Briefly in response to Susan, as I recall, the third example, the last of the examples, was a pre-Sackett and Hawkes situation, and Sackett and Hawkes would give you the tools necessary to keep that from happening today. So that's an illustration of how those recent opinions can be valuable in this context. The other thing I wanted to say about Tyler's remarks, I was harshly critical of a lot of the regulatory actions that were taken during the Trump administration. So when those three executive orders came out, I read them with an entering attitude of skepticism and concern. But after reading over them a couple of times, I said, no, these are just fine. I think they're quite carefully drafted. I'd say 90% at least is just codification of existing laws. I read them, I was jotting down quickly just names of cases or short references to cases that supported the principle. The few that are not clearly supported by precedent are just kind of common sense riffs on what courts have said. So and I'd actually urge somebody to think about if you know somebody, a professor who's looking for an article topic or a student who wants to write a good note, you could take, say, the third of those executive orders and annotate it. Do an article or essay or note in which you say, okay, here's what this says. Here's the case law that supports it, and go through the whole thing. So I thought it was a useful codification, and I was not generally a fan of the Trump administration. So
appreciate the exception.
Professor Gavor, I think Professor Pierce did have some criticisms of some of your suggestions. Now that you're Dean, would you like to comment on your colleague?
I'm not his dean. I'm just the associate dean for academic affairs. So I help with the curriculum and part-time faculty. I think they're well-stated viewpoints. When my co-author and I laid out the menu of options, obviously we weren't going to mention anything that we couldn't get behind. And I think it's just a difference of opinion. My view is, I'm very dubious of hearsay exceptions. The court allows for reliable hearsay in administrative behavior in the context of formal adjudication, but generally speaking, I think it's a policy preference. Perhaps not all of the federal rules of evidence, but maybe just some of them might be suitable. And I also think administrative behavior from 1986 undoubtedly is very different. In 2021, so maybe some of the factual predicates are different. And then also with regard to access to privileged materials, it's a hard one, right? Because he makes a good point with regard to Larry Nassar. But also at the same time, Susan makes an equally good point that even if there are rules to allow privileged information, agencies don't necessarily follow them. So My solution with Steve is, why not have a separation of functions and also have the classic diffusion of discretion that the administrative state has in spades for all kinds of other conduct, and apply that in administrative investigations.
Any other comments? All right. We do have time for a question or two, if there are any. Gentleman here.
Hello. I'm Mike Doherty. I'm not a lawyer. I'm the president of LabMD, who've spent 12 years being shredded by the fine Federal Trade Commission. So I'd like to ask Professor Pierce about what's wrong with having administrative procedures under the rules of evidence and civil procedure, because my experience is tons of hearsay came in. My lawyers had no experience in those courtrooms with that. The media ran with it. You can't say it's not true, no one believes you. And 6 years later, oops, we were wrong. And it's because the whole legal system, when you try to get a lawyer to come into this, they're like, I'm in kangaroo court, I don't know the rules there. And then you end up in an Article III court anyway. So why do we have to have this circle and confuse rule book that only benefits the agency and leaves the poor citizen defendants who've lost a medical facility out in the swamp, so to speak? I try to ask that gently.
So the rules of evidence, I mean, you go through provision by provision, and there are many, many provisions that says what the judge needs to do here is look at the evidence and decide whether the jury should be allowed to consider it, okay? Because that's the only point at which you can assure that a decision is not made based on extremely weak evidence. At the point of admission, because it, once the jury sees it, you have no way in the world of knowing why the jury decided it. In any administrative case, there is a decision that tells you what they relied on and what they didn't rely on. That is a much, much better opportunity to sit down and figure out, is this evidence sufficiently reliable and probative to be the basis for this decision? And that's what courts do routinely. It makes no sense at all to instead engage in the very, very crude practices that are necessary in the context of a jury trial to make sure that jurors have no access to any evidence that they might abuse in the processes of their decision making. We know that they operate primarily based on emotion. Everybody knows you start a case with the sobbing parents holding the baby who's been injured on one side, and the doctor, well known to be insured, on the other side. The case is over. Okay, you don't even need more evidence than that.
So we shouldn't have
jury trials. That's not the case with agencies.
Can I follow up?
Please.
Okay. So how do you propose then you rein in the abusive agencies? Because with all due respect, I've got tons of transcripts that will show outrageous lying, especially from the 11th Circuit Court of Appeals to the FTC, saying you participated in shakedowns. Now, the problem is there's nothing to protect the people that are getting abused by this weaponization of this process until you get to that point, and most people don't climb Justice Mountain that far because they're not crazy like me. But I can tell you, with all due respect, it is being abused like crazy by the SEC and the FTC, for starters, because they all share the game with each other. So the credibility of the courts has been compromised, and the integrity is. That's why we have evidently annoying things like a jury, because that's supposed to be by the people. And what happened by not having that protection is we lost a medical facility with 700,000 patients, and now they're saying, sorry, we were wrong, here's $800,000. And see, that's the type of thing that story has to stop. So is there a way to protect from that if we're not going to allow those rules?
Yeah, I don't know the facts of those cases.
Well, we didn't have any babies
but
crying.
That's why judicial review exists. That's the opportunity to say, okay, this agency did the wrong thing. And so we're hereby reversing it and vacating it. That's I know of no better remedy than that.
If I might add a point, there are two other residual values to having at least some federal rules of evidence grafted upon agency administrative adjudication, because they are familiar and consistent standards. So to the extent we can agree upon whether or if some of them are appropriate to graft on, they would then first benefit from the case law and great familiarity among the Article III jurists who are reviewing agency action, which, by the way, agency findings of fact are deeply deferential under 706 2A through E. And second, I think it would allow greater access to justice and perhaps more willingness for litigators with general civil litigation background to delve into administrative law issues, because it's not going to be some sort of arcane mysticism that is associated just with one agency or a particular administrative law judge, and it's going to be more generally applicable.
And I'd like to add to, so first of all, thanks for being here. And, you know, having many clients similarly situated to you, I sympathize with your position. You know, hopefully, it sounds like you did this, you ultimately triumphed in the end, but hire really good lawyers and see if you can clamp down on it at the beginning. Sometimes I've found the most effective thing is lobbying efforts through the agency, hire folks who know everyone in the enforcement division, and that is the best way to negotiate in the beginning. But, you know, when you get to talk about the federal rules of evidence, I've even found, I've been in interviews or really their depositions of sorts where the attorneys don't even know the federal rules of evidence because they're not practitioners, they're government attorneys. And I was once a government attorney, so, no offense there. It's just sometimes they don't necessarily know that. And oftentimes investigations actually start out based on hearsay, and I don't think that's ever going to change. You know, you get a tip from a complainant, you even get tips from competitors who might purposely try to get an investigation going to gain a competitive advantage.
Well, I would say FedSoc is what led us to great lawyers, I must say. It's where I came here 7 years ago and got pro bono defense, so that's also
go.
Great tea.
Good.
We have a gentleman in the back.
So traditionally, administrative law judges have been very independent, both in their selection and in their removal. But this has recently been ended by the Supreme Court, recognizing that there are offices of the United States as a part of the executive branch, and therefore appointed by and removable by heads of agencies. As that happens, do you see that there is a substantial problem with due process where a government is selecting the judge in their own cause, able to remove that judge if they don't like how they're ruling, and perhaps moving administrative law judges into being closer to federal magistrates may be a good option for reining in the agencies?
In short, yes. I'm very concerned about that. I've written on it extensively. I've been looking for the right case to raise, to argue on a due process basis. But the problem is, in a sense, worse even than you, in the way you frame it, because in addition to the administrative law judges, there's, 2,000 of them, there's 11,400 other judicial officers employed by agencies that perform analogous functions that have no safeguards whatsoever. That is of great concern. And the article I referred to by Kent Barnett in the recent issue of Duke Law Journal was actually an article written in that context, that if we cannot get safeguards through statute or through application of the due process clause, well, at least every agency should come up with rules that provide safeguards for those adjudicative officers, so that they know that they're not going to be fired or demoted or sent to Siberia if they make a decision that offends the government.
Last question.
Yeah, Dean, I was just curious. I'll tell you why I'm asking this question. In all your research, did you find an example of where a career person who was perhaps overly aggressive, going beyond whatever boundaries they may have established, was punished in some way for being aggressive in that way? And the reason I'm bringing that up is we can have all the Trump executive orders or whatever, but it's all paper in the end, because when you're down at that lower base, very few people have the wherewithal to go up to the courts and challenge whatever that career person's doing. And the political people are all busy on big stuff. This is not sexy things. And unless you have some kind of penalty that's associated with violating whatever these norms might be at the career level, it's all paper, I think. And the other part is there a way to penalize agencies for bringing frivolous cases, such as strengthening the Equal Access to Justice Act, which we did on the Hill one time and got a bill through the House, by removing the requirement that a company has to show that the that the agency's position was not substantially justified, such that the attorney's fees would be automatically awarded upon the business showing that its position was vindicated. So, I mean, you got to penalize the agency for bringing frivolous cases, and you got to have some deterrence, I think, on career people who go beyond the boundaries and are just abusive to the employer community or whoever it is. Otherwise, it's sort of a lot of paper, and it's subject to people being able to hire good lawyers to go up to the courts of appeals, and that's going to be one out of 100 cases at best. Otherwise, it's a lot of talk that's not going to help in that small guy.
Great series of questions. So the first one is, I am not aware of a government bureaucrat in an agency that is not the Justice Department that has gotten in trouble for that kind of conduct. And that's different from just general ethics violations or stealing money and the like. DOJ attorneys will sometimes get in trouble in defending agency action as they interact with the Article III courts, sometimes unfairly, because they just have the case and they have to defend it and there's a legal basis to defend it, but nothing of the class that you're describing. And I think you're right in the sense that the term penalties for agencies does not have the same effect as a penalty would on a private sector corporation. It's not that agencies have a sense of shame or something like that. They just continue to exist. And it's not like the employee is going to have an adverse consequence for engaging within the boundaries of the employment, so long as it's not outrageous one way or the other. So I think in terms of providing assets or resources to bring to bear to control executive branch behavior, it requires political power, oversight in the context of the power of the purse, committees of oversight engaging in hearings. So in the LabMD context, House OGR had a hearing, if I recall, over Tyversa, a data security firm in Pennsylvania that may or may not have referred the LabMD data breach for a LimeWire misuse after they initially tried to get business from LabMD. And LabMD said no. So the solutions are not easy ones.
And I'd like to add on that, having been at an agency, I think to the extent that you need paper, you need rules. You need rules of agency procedure or regulations in place, because absent that, there's no mechanism for holding a career employee accountable. If you have rules of agency procedure or regulations in place, and you have a political appointee, you've equipped that political appointee with a cause to discipline that employee. Absent that kind of rule of agency procedure, any sorts of internal procedures of a kind that I think a lot of us in this room would like, it is very difficult to discipline a career employee. So you need actual rules of agency procedure. You need not handbooks in the pejorative sense, but some sort of procedure. Yeah, there you go. Some sort of procedure internally whereby a political appointee with fortitude can fire or discipline that career employee. Absent the paper, as you pejoratively characterized it, you're not in a position to bring down the hammer on a career employee.
And I would also add, I think many career employees of the federal government genuinely attempt to uphold their oath to the Constitution as they engage in their work, but there's enough of them who don't, which gives rise to the problems.
I just wanted to chime in and agree completely with both your suggestion and Tyler's important qualification of it, that there has to be rules that you can show were violated, but I'm with you. I think any employee who violates rules in this or other context should be punished. And I'll tell you, there is a movement, an interesting movement, to extend that way of thinking into criminal law. We had, for instance, a rather notorious case lately in which a famous actor had his conviction for multiple counts of rape reversed based on prosecutorial misconduct. And I was just looking at a draft of an article the other day where the author is arguing that instead of that punishment, which is not a punishment of the prosecutor, it is a punishment of the public and the victims of the crime, instead of that punishment, there should be a punishment for prosecutorial misconduct. And she looked at a lot of cases involving prosecutorial misconduct and didn't find a single one where the prosecutor suffered any consequence. In some cases, they actually were praised.
Well, that is perhaps a depressing way of closing today's panel. But c'est la vie. Before I adjourn the session, I've been asked to announce that the Scalia reception and dinner begins at 6 p.m. So if you're planning to attend, you should start to make your way over to Union Station shortly. And with that, please join me in thanking our wonderful panel today.